everybody. This is Tracy Malone from NarcissistAbuseSupport.com. I gotta like be a little jingle out of that or something. I am going to bring us today an expert that I actually had her come to my in-person support group, we think about 5 or 6 years ago. It's been a while. Dr. Carol McBride is the Bible person for me of healing daughters of narcissistic mothers. This book, Will I Ever Be Good Enough, is, one of her founding books. She then went on to have a divorce book. But today we're going to talk about her newest book, Will the Drama Ever End? And this is Untangling and Healing the Harmful Effects of Parental Narcissism. What does it do to the family? What does it do to the child victim of a narcissistic parent? We are going to do this, and I'm going to play a game with her. And I first listened to it, and then I read it so that I could highlight stuff so that we could make the best out of her time as I have waited 6 years to get her on my screen. So I'm so excited. Let's go welcome Carol. We're going to learn like just what it looks like, what it sounds like, and talk about the healing that she helps people grow through in her book. You'll get the whole chapter on what it is. So let's go meet Carol, and I'll see you on the other side. Hello, Carol. I am so excited that you're here today.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, do you think it's been about 5 or 6 years since you came to my group in Boulder?
Yeah, I think so, right? Yeah, because we were talking about my first book then, so that's been a while.
Been a long time, absolutely. Yeah. So today we are here, and we are going to talk about your new book, which you have on your screen, and I'm holding up, Will the Drama Ever End, right? It is the book for the effects on the family, because your first book was, Will I Ever Be Good Enough? Daughters, Healing the Daughters of Narcissistic Mothers. And I tell men to buy this book, like just flip the whole vernacular. Mm-hmm. It is the Bible, and like literally mine is all worn out and used so much. So I'm so excited about your expertise that we're going to talk about today, because there's effects on the family. There's things that happen, right? So we're going to start off we're going to play a game. And I'm going to throw you some words, and we'll have categories. I want to talk about the narcissistic parent first. And so I'm just going to throw you some words, and then you'll go back and we'll just have a game like that. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Do I get a prize at the end? So the first one I want to talk about is the overt and the covert narcissistic parent. What do you want to tell us about that?
Well, the overt, I think, is what people typically think about, out there, in your face, boisterous, arrogant, bragging, look at me, making a big show. Where the covert is just more behind the scenes, but more silent, more passive aggressive, still manipulative, still doing the same kind of damage. It's just not as obvious and in your face.
Yeah. And a lot of my clients, I just had a new group this morning, and one of them was like, I just realized my mother is a narcissist, like 60 years later, right? It's because usually that covert, we're expecting the bang, we're expecting the grandiose and all of that. So we don't suspect that they could be calm and on the face to other people seem normal and nice, right, and still be silently abusing their children.
Yeah. And I think, Tracy, one of the reasons for that people get sort of confused or not sure what this is about is because in general, I think the term narcissism has been overused in our culture now. And most people think of it as someone who's just boastful and arrogant and is all about them, right? But if we really think about, what harms people, those are the things that worry me. Like, I don't really care if someone's braggy and boastful and all about them and they talk about everything they've done and blah, blah. Who cares? It's the stuff. I mean, you might want to stay away from them, but they might be annoying. But what I care about is what are the things that hurt relationships, mm-hmm. right? Like, things like exploiting people for your own needs, the lack of empathy, the inability to emotionally tune in to someone else, the jealousy, you know, the thing, these are the things that are really hurtful. And it doesn't matter, going back to your question, covert or overt, it doesn't matter which one it is. This is what happens with this disorder.
Absolutely. And you know, to a narcissistic parent, image is everything. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's when we talk about the narcissist, image is everything for them, but then we translate it into what I wrote about in this new book, The Narcissistic Family. And when I say narcissistic family, I mean a family led by a narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the alcoholic family is led by the alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
So the image it is the mantra of the narcissistic family, right? It's the we have to present and we have to put forward this picture of the perfect family.
Mm-hmm.
At all times. And it doesn't really matter how you feel. It matters how it looks to others.
Absolutely. I grew up in a family like that. And my mother's mantra was children are to be seen and not heard, mm-hmm. except when, say, Paul Newman's in the living room, you can come over, bow nicely in your prettiest dress and go back up to your room. You know, it's like, we're just there as little puppets to come out and like, oh, look, I have children. Allez, she would say. She didn't speak French. She just said Allez all the time. Get away, right? So it was image of her perfect life. I've got these beautiful little girls. But as soon as the door closed, she was evil and wicked, right? But that was the image that I think people need to understand is on the surface, they are just portraying what they want to portray.
Yeah, and what reflects well on them, unfortunately. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. All right, let's talk about the lack of empathy or personal boundaries.
Well, the lack of empathy, I mean, it isn't that just, I mean, just to think about that for a minute, isn't that an interesting thing to think about? Like any of us who can do empathy, who are empathic people, it's really hard to get your head around how someone may not have this functioning. It's almost like there's a piece missing in the brain or something, you know, where they just can't emotionally tune in mm-hmm. to other people's feelings. And of course, in any loving relationship, in any parenting relationship, in any friendship, if you don't have empathy, you can't have trust and you can't have love.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And again, to not have empathy for your own children and their struggles or their life is what really messes up the adult child later in life, is that they didn't have anyone that cared if they did their homework, except that you better get good grades or you'll be punished because of our image, right?
Right. So
it's sort of like they don't understand the child's struggles and the child ends up having to parent themselves a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, we have another word which is really big in the family dynamic system of triangulation.
Yes, and triangulation is just really, in a nutshell, is lack of direct communication. I mean, if you're triangulating, you're putting your message through another person, hoping it'll get back to the original person that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
instead of just directly speaking to someone about whatever's going on.
Yeah.
And of course, in a triangulated conversation where you're expecting your message to go through this person, to go over here, to get back to this one in that triangle,
mm-hmm.
the message can get diluted
mm-hmm.
and can get messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes then once it gets back to the person is not even correct. Like the old game of telephone we used to play when we were little, right? you know, where you gossip around the circle. But the problem with it, I mean, there's always going to be some triangulation in a family, I think, but the problem with it is it's a way to avoid direct communication. It's a way to avoid a conflict, and avoid dealing with feelings.
Absolutely.
And narcissists do not deal with feelings. They're not in touch with their own feelings enough to do that. So they set up this sort of weird communication in the family.
And often in the triangulation model, you see the narcissistic parent pitting two siblings against each other. Again, we'll talk about roles later, but the golden and the scapegoat are pitted and become mortal enemies to divide the family so that they aren't stronger against the narcissistic parent, correct?
Yes. Yeah, and it really is a way for the narcissist, therefore, to stay in control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think the last one on the narcissistic parent that I want to hit is how they put their needs above the child's. Say about that.
Yeah, another mantra of the narcissistic family is the parental needs take precedence over the children's needs. Now, if you think about a healthy family structure, or what is a healthy family dynamic, there's a hierarchy. You know, the parents are up here, the kids are down here, and not in an authoritative way, but in a way that we're up here as the parent to shine down, to direct, to teach, to guide, to love, to nurture the children. And that's what makes children feel safe. In the narcissistic family, that's reversed. And we, the children, then are there to take care of the narcissistic parent. At an age, usually at all, many ages, as the child is growing up, where the children aren't capable of doing that. They don't have the experience, the life experience, the maturity there. And, you know, I think there are several reasons, but I think that's one of the reasons, Tracy, that this common theme of not feeling good enough, that's one of the big places it comes from. Because if I'm a kid and my job is to keep you happy, mommy, and I can't do it, but I don't know why I can't do it, but I'm failing all the time because mommy or daddy or whoever the narcissist is here is not happy. You know, and kids don't know that, they don't understand that, right?
It puts a huge burden on the child. In my family, again, narc mother and father, but both my sisters had earlier roles of taking care of mom. My older sister first, my younger sister in my mother's almost dying age, and me when she was dying. And when I got her to a hospital here in Colorado and they were doing the intake and the doctor's like, oh, you're so lucky to have your daughter helping you here, you know? And she looked at the doctor, she goes, you know, I'm really surprised that Tracy's the one to take care of me while I'm dying, because I never liked her. She was always my least favorite. He said that to the doctor. The doctor like dropped his pen and he's like, did I just hear that? Like, it was so weird because I was never the favorite. I was always the scapegoat or forgotten child. And so they were the ones until they fell off their reign. And then almost rotated through. You can help me when I'm throwing up over the toilet for my older sister. And you can help me in this part of my life when I got a divorced other sister. And Tracy, you can guide me when I'm dying, right? We all had a role in the family dynamic.
Wow.
Horrible. So now we're kind of leading into the effects, because that was my lead into the effects. It was a perfect fit to say, how does it affect the child? Like, Codependency is my first word that I want to throw at you, because a lot of victims of a parental narcissism end up in the codependent because of that caregiving we just described.
That's right. That's right. I always say the narcissistic family is boot camp. It's like boot camp for codependency, right? We learn it and we learn it well. Because that's the job, really. Again, looking at that hierarchy, that's the job of the child in the narcissistic family to watch out for and take care of the parent, which causes codependency, because the term codependency really means I will take care of you to the exclusion of taking care of myself, which is why it's a problem. And it's kind of interesting because codependents are some of the nicest people you'll ever meet.
Absolutely.
And that's why, because they take care. I mean, they're so nice, which we don't want to lose that part of us, but we have to make sure we take care of ourselves, in the process.
Yeah, that's the recovery, is to learn that equal time. If you want to still care for people, fine, but really yourself has to be priority. And it rolls into our next word, which is shame, because so many adult children of narcissists hold a lot of shame.
That's such an interesting dynamic, I think, because it's almost, I visualize it like, those big nets, Tracy, that basketball players use, where they're carrying this big net with all these basketballs. You know what I'm talking about? And it's like we come out of these families and we got the net and we got all these big balls of problems and shame and guilt and low self-worth and all the stuff that came from the family that got projected onto us. And we're walking around carrying this heavy, which is what I think is the shame. Like we carry the shame for the whole family. And I really see recovery. I often say to my clients, it's like, it feels like in recovery, here we are with our bag of crappy balls, out there, and we're taking one ball at a time and going, whew, done. Whew, we're getting rid of them as we're freeing ourselves and untangling from this dysfunction.
Absolutely. I love the metaphor. I'm always going to use the basketballs in a big bag behind them, because I actually use, let me see my little toys. I actually have these little balls that I use, and I'm like, shame, guilt, and I stick them to my shirt. Won't stick today, but it's that same concept. It's like they're all over us. We are gobbling up fear and low self-worth and all of these things, because if we were so busy taking care of other people, we didn't have time to find self-worth. Nobody told us what we were doing was right. It was always wrong. We had to try harder. And so when we get to the self-worth part, we're like, well, I help people. You've lost all of that. And that is one of the byproducts, I think, right?
And shame is a difficult thing to shed. It's diff because shame is something that, permeates our whole being. It's not like we did this one thing and it's something we can, make sense of. Shame, it permeates. Shame does something to the sense of self.
Well, shame is I am bad. Guilt is I did something bad. Shame is core level. I am
Yeah,
bad.
that's a good differentiation. Yes.
It eats you from inside, that you are the poison here that's working, because you believe that you're not worthy, because that's what you've been told, perhaps, right? And so that worthiness journey is something that comes in. But I think self-sabotage is also kind of tied to it. If you have no self-worth, then you're going to continuously self-sabotage yourself. How does that work into this dynamic?
Well, it's if you in the narcissistic family, you're not encouraged to build that sense of self like you're talking about, for several reasons. But when you when you are operating in life without a solid core sense of self, then, I mean, that is going to affect everything you do, basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, all of these things, picturing the big balls, we pluck one off, we work on that, we really understand, we let go of fears, we let go of things that we believed because we were told that from our family, right? Fear is another thing that narcissistic parents controlled with, you know, you better do this, you have to do this, you know, it becomes your responsibility. And so the fear of not doing it, and that's why we're so usually very responsible, we're the codependents, responsible, people pleasing, loving people, because we always had to try harder, right?
Yeah.
The dynamic that happens with this is amazing, right? There's also a lot of abandonment wounds, I think, that happen because a narcissistic parent really was never there for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like the emotionally orphaned child, you know? I mean, they're there to do oftentimes, and sometimes not, but oftentimes the roof over the head and the clothes to wear and the food to eat. You know, but that tuning into you emotionally and seeing you and hearing you and feeling you and being there for you is what's missing.
Yeah. And that all just rings so true to every client that I've ever had, where they just struggle with all of these challenges. But I think something that I see and lived is because of the narcissistic family unit, I married them. I didn't, it was normalized, right? So there's tell me about the tie between someone who has had this in their life with a parent, and then, and we're not choosing this, we were conned into thinking the person we were with was something other than what they ended up being, right? But the tie to choosing narcissists later in life.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot too, i.e. why I wrote my second book about divorcing a narcissist, right? And I know you wrote something similar. And I think it's that until recovery, unconsciously, we seem to be attracted to the familiar. So there's this dynamic that we're attracted to, we don't even realize we're attracted to until we're in it, and then it's happening, and then we're like, oh, geez, what did I do now? You know? So I think that's part of it. I also think the codependency, let me backtrack that. I think it's the, in the narcissistic family, we learn the wrong definition of love. We learn that love is about either what you can do for me or what I can do for you, which that brings in what I was about to say, the dependent and the codependent, right? And that's the wrong definition of love. That's not love. What we can do for each other? No, love is loving who you are. You know, your personhood. I think those reasons is we're drawn to that dysfunction because we thought that was normal.
Normalized, like, again, I love your explanation of, you know, we didn't know love. We thought that was love. And so when we get into another situation where, I had a meeting this morning and 8 women on the screen and they did everything for this person, right? They did it all. There was never anyone who helped them in the marriage, right? They were doing it, but it's because they were so normalized to, I can do it, so why not? I'll do it. Sure. You want me to do that? Yeah, sure. You know, and again, it's normal for us and not going, why aren't they doing their share? Because we didn't live with anyone doing their share. We did it all.
And, you know, maybe if I do and do and do and do and do and do, maybe you'll love me. And maybe you'll love me more than my mommy did or my daddy, right? I mean, sometimes, Tracy, I think it's almost trying to master the trauma. know, if I wasn't loved properly when I was being raised, if I, maybe I can meet you and you're going to love me. And let me just think of all these things I can do to make you love me more, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's the mantra for every victim of narcissistic abuse is we think if we do it, then they love us. And, you know, the bottom line is you're talking to, as I usually use, my purple mug cannot love you. You know, it's just not capable of loving us, but we don't see that because it is so familiar. And the next part I want to go into is really the effects on the family. You talk a lot about the family roles in the book. And the scapegoat, the golden, and you actually said something about the clown, and I went, I tried to be the clown, but it didn't work out. So I ended up being the lost child because I wasn't one of their caregivers in the beginning, right? I was here doing my own stuff. I think that's why I survived. Both of my siblings are narcissists and are, you know, entitled and all of this stuff. And I'm like, not that girl. So I think it's because I was that sort of lost child that I just learned to take care of myself. Of course, I still learned the bad patterns and married them, right? But I want you to talk about the golden, the scapegoat. What do these roles have to do and how do the parents manipulate those roles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting that you know, why is it that this is common? Why is it that we see this over and over again, that we can actually be having this conversation that in the narcissistic family, there tends to be either two narcissistic parents or one narcissistic parent and then the enabler who orbits around the narcissist. Mm-hmm. And then for whatever reason, you know, there tends to be a kid that's a scapegoat that is blamed for everything. Mm-hmm. And all of the self-loathing, ugly feelings that the narcissist has for themselves gets projected onto the poor scapegoat. Mm-hmm. And so then the scapegoat is the one who's really internalizing more, carrying a lot of shame for the family. And they tend to be oftentimes the one, though, that calls out the inconsistencies, the dishonesty. Oftentimes it's the scapegoat child that is the one who says, hold on a minute. I'm not sure this all is correct here. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with this picture, you know? Mm-hmm. The golden child is the one where, you know, we talk about the narcissist having this almost idealized image of themselves, like I'm so great and I'm so wonderful and I'm the best at everything. And that idealized image is what sort of gets projected onto the golden child. Now, can you imagine the pressure of that?
Mm-hmm.
And the golden child, even though it sounds like it would be really cool to be the golden child, like, oh, I'm mommy's favorite or daddy's favorite, but they have a lot of pressure too. They, because they may be like super uber special in our family right now, but when they go out into the big bad world, they're no golden child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they get hit with like, oh, maybe I'm a fraud. That wasn't, you know, really real. And they kind of feel like the imposter. They also, I think, the golden child has a harder time individuating. Mm. Because they're usually the one that is more enmeshed with the narcissist. You know what I mean? Because they're the favorite.
Absolutely.
So they have a harder time breaking away too. So a lot of people think like, oh, if I can only be the golden child, well, they carry their own set of unhealthy issues.
Yeah.
And then the lost child is just kind of, I'm not, you know, I'm going to be invisible. I'm going to blend in. I'm going to survive by withdrawing. And that's how I'm going to survive in this family. Now, you mentioned the clown. I think I know people talk about the clown role in the alcoholic family. I don't think we see the clown role in the narcissistic family. And it's interesting what you said a few minutes ago, because if you think about the clown role, they get attention because they're cute and they're funny and right. And that's threatening to the narcissist who needs all the attention. So that's why I think we don't see that one as much in the narcissistic family.
My mother was an alcoholic too, but at the same time, the same reasons you're talking about, she needed the attention. You know, it was shut down. It was squelched. If that was your strength, every strength you had going to be squelched. So it was my way to make light of it and let's all get along. And I was the peacekeeper in a way. And that clown kind of folded in there, but quickly it was, don't be that person and you're not allowed because I'm stealing juice and energy from her, right?
There you go. That's so it.
It was like, oh, stay in line, go back to the girl we just leave upstairs, you're like forgotten. Well, let's just do that one, right? And it was sort of like taken, just as someone who might be like an expert pianist, it's robbed from them because you can't outshine the mom or the dad, right? And so for me, I tried it, but it was like, whoa, you're not allowed to do that. And you get back in line and you eat all of that up, but it creates a rivalry between the siblings, right? If you've got one that's a golden and one that is the scapegoat and one that doesn't even care about what's going on, right? There's jealousy. It's always this back and forth between the siblings of, you know, mommy loves me more, or that sort of like dialogue, instead of we're a family and we love each other, it becomes a family of destructive language that we talk to even the siblings with each other because of the roles given by the narc parent.
And you know, this is a really important issue, I think, for people to understand, because it's another loss. It ends up being another loss for children of narcissists, because you know, they've already don't have that closeness that they need with the narcissistic parent or the enabler. But, you know, the siblings, if they, as you say, are pitted against each other and taught competition and taught to do comparisons all the time, many, many times when these people then become adults, they're not close as siblings. And a lot of my clients will talk about, you know, how come my friends like go on vacations with their siblings and everybody gets together at Christmas and we don't even talk, you know, we might text Merry Christmas and that's it. Like there's a real distance that happens. And that is another loss that is significant, I think.
And there's a grieving. I taught grieving this morning. So there's a grieving because you're talking. That's where we went with this is we're grieving for the family that we should have had that does go on vacation. I've said to my channel and I've said it to my clients and I'm like, I've never been on vacation on a plane with my family, not one of them. I've never done anything that's normal. I haven't had Christmases since I'm 18. I mean, most of them are dead now, but still, we never had that. And I'd be like, everyone's going off to the family. And here's something that it happens to a lot of families or a lot of victims like myself, is I married both of my husbands because they had a good family. They were close. And I was like, oh, that's what I want, right? And that's another side effect is that because we didn't have that family that does that, that when we go searching for a partner, to me, that was a strong selling point, if you would. I didn't know they were psychopaths, but I thought they were a strong family. They went on vacations together. And to me, that was feeling that hole that I didn't get with mine.
Totally makes sense. Absolutely.
It's
because we all want, it's something we all want. We all want to say we come from this big, loving family. Everybody loves each other and it's so warm and wonderful. I mean, that's what we want, right?
So we search and then we marry it and until we find out We had the other patterns that made us choose bad families, right? Without seeing it. Again, the normalization of crazy comes into a picking of, oh, I'm picking you for your family, not knowing exactly much about them and just going, give me family, right? So it's another wound that victims have to suffer with, is that they didn't have that. They either have to grieve it or look for it.
And that's really important in recovery, is, you know, how do we then build our own family with our, either our own children and grandchildren and our own relationships, or friends, people that we know that we gather as our family now. Because that's really important, because people need family, you know?
Absolutely. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. We're on our last chapter of the game. You're ready to play. It's the part about healing. And I love all of your stuff. It's, you know, it comes through in the steps that you've got. One of the healing processes is journaling. And I'm a huge journaler. I have 36 journals that I've written for people to heal with, right? Journaling gets into your brain and lets you release things that you've been holding. So tell us about journaling, or some of the other parts that we need to do to get through this and heal.
Mm-hmm. I like journaling too. I am all about processing trauma. Mm-hmm. So people who come out of these families, what I call the narcissistic family, any dysfunctional family, are going to come out with some complex PTSD likely. Mm-hmm. And that means that there's been trauma that has gone on for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And so we can't just get over that already. Like, that trauma has to be processed. Mm-hmm. And so the journaling is just another way to process trauma. Mm-hmm. So I also believe very strongly in kind of a structured way to do this, which is why I developed the 5-step recovery model that I talk about in all my books, but it's far more refined in the new book now. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've seen this. I've seen it a lot, where when people come and want to talk about this trauma, they're flooded. It's you open the can of worms and it's like a flood, and it needs direction, you know, and so I learned this the hard way that, you know, we got to break this down now, and we got to take this step by step by step in order for people to get through this healing process. Otherwise, it sort of feels like you're just swimming in it, mm-hmm. and it's not making any sense, and it feels like it goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it kind of overwhelms the therapist and the person trying to help too. Because it, all this stuff is coming at you and you're like, whoa, where do we start? You know? So I've developed this 5-step model that I believe I've seen in my practice, if you work it in sequence, at least try to, This is the route that I've found, at least, for a solid recovery program for us.
And it works. I mean, I've been following all your steps through all the books and helping clients through it as well, because it's not just journaling. It's the grieving. It's going through that. It's processing that trauma, as you said. There comes a point where you're accepting what happened versus living in denial land, and that helps. That, I mean, each hump is like you're getting getting closer. I think one of the important things for me was separation, and really, I mean, most of them are dead. One is not, but I've been no contact for about 9 months, and that was what I needed, because I was getting a daily digestion of trauma, and you can't get past it until there is that separation. Can you talk to the separation part of this?
I can. And it's step two of my 5-step recovery program is called separation individuation. Mm-hmm. And when I talk about it, it can be geographic or no contact, but what I'm really referring to is a psychological separation from the dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So that this dysfunctional web here of the family dynamics isn't sucking you in anymore, and you're no longer a part of it, and you're no longer afraid of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes some work. And it takes first accepting what we do in step one. It takes accepting the disorder and working on a lot of the trauma before we're able to separate and individuate. But it separating is getting out of that web,
mm-hmm.
So that you can begin to work on yourself. And you become more objective. You know, I think I gave this example in a book, and I use it with clients. It's almost like we're in a theater, and here's the stage, and the family's up on the stage acting out all their dynamics, but we're not up there with them anymore. We're sitting back in the audience. And we can be much more objective now, and we can be like, oh, there's that, you know, but I'm not going to be up there doing it anymore. So it's a more pulled back,
mm-hmm.
objective stance that people get to in individuation separation, which is really healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they can't really move on to work on sense of self and setting good boundaries and all the other parts of recovery until they're out of the web. They're off the stage.
Exactly. I do have a movie theater NLP exercise that I take people through that is just doing that, looking down at it, and yeah. It's not you, and you're separating yourself, and you know, there's so much messaging going on that, mm-hmm. I think there's so many steps in your five that are going to take people through this if they've done nothing in their life. Buy her book, because if you follow these steps, you will be able to do it. Certainly going through it with someone like Carol is going to help you, or all of the people that you've trained, because you train therapists all over the world, right? They've learned the Carol McBride method. And so there's people out there that can help you, but just starting with the book, if you've not done anything, is just the way we have to do that. We have to learn to reparent ourselves. Can you talk about the reparenting of ourselves? Because a lot of people don't understand that. When I say, let's talk to our inner child now, they're like, what?
I know. Yeah, it's you have to sort of view that there's a wounded child inside of you that needs to be parented because they didn't get the parenting that they were supposed to. So now we as adults have to take our adult maternal or paternal self and reparent that wounded child. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about reparenting, we're really talking to and comforting and soothing that wounded child, and helping them feel safe so they can have the feelings they're having and letting it be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And loving ourselves, right? We just didn't get it from them. So it's about learning to love yourself again, back to the codependency of above anyone else, not in a narcissistic way, but putting your needs in the mix as important as someone else's are.
Yeah. And you know, what I think is really kind of, I found anyway, and I don't know if you've had this experience, you probably have, that when you bring up self-love or self-compassion, mm-hmm. People are like, huh?
Yes.
Like it's really hard if you haven't been loved in the right way to know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. So what I end up doing, and I again learned this the hard way, is let's go back to self-acceptance.
Mm.
Before we move into self-love and self-compassion, which is all great, I love it, let's all do it eventually. But what I learned is that we have to do self-acceptance first.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, self-acceptance is saying, I am going to accept me for who I am. Authentic self acceptance. Now, that means I've made mistakes. That means I have weaknesses and I have strength. And once people are able to do that, then moving into self-love and self-compassion actually works, right?
Yeah, because if you don't accept yourself, you're going to keep hitting the wall here. It's never going to get there. So that's brilliant. Yeah,
because it's like, but wait a minute. I did this back in 1989. I'm like, okay, but we're all human. We all make mistakes. We're all on this human journey together, right? It's okay. It's okay to be real, you know?
And if you think about the narcissistic parent who you can never do anything right for, you can never do enough for, right? That's where your lack of self-love and self-acceptance is. I didn't do enough. I could have done more. I should have done more. You're sitting in this loop that until you go, warts and freckles and imperfectly perfect is what is fine. We don't have to be what our parents projected us to hold on to that we can never achieve because the bar just kept moving. You got to here, you got the honor student thing. And well, why did you wear that dress to there? You know, you're like, you can't do anything right. So accepting yourself for your warts, your freckles, your whatever it is, and just going, it's who I am. And I love me. And when you love you, then you can bring someone else truly into your life because they are not filling that happy hole for you.
That's right. Yeah. That's very good. Yes.
So this is the end of the game and you win a prize. I'm not sure what it will be, but you have one in all of our groups. Can you tell people how to get in touch with you and learn more other than going to Amazon or wherever you want to and buying her book? How else can they get in touch with you?
I think probably the main place that has all our links, all our resources, everything you can find that I'm doing in this field is on the book website, which is just simply willieverbegoodenough.com. Mm-hmm. All three books are on there. There are other resources. Our therapist registry is there. We have workshops there. We have our Facebook link, our social media link. So willieverbegoodenough.com will take you to all of it.
Perfect. Well, I can't thank you enough. It has been so many years and I am so grateful. This is going to help a lot of people and hopefully lead them to your work so that they can heal as well. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tracy. I've enjoyed talking to you. Thanks.
I am so excited. I hope you guys learned something there. She literally is just the best expert to bring us the parental narcissism, the what happens, the what it looks like, and everything that she shared with us today. I hope that you take this home with you and you go buy her book because it's going to help you if you have a parental narcissist or like we talked about, where your family, your siblings don't even talk to each other. How do we heal from that abandonment wound of our family? How do we heal from the grieving of not having a real family? How do we deal with all the steps? Right here in the book. So go get her book. If you haven't subscribed to my channel, please do. I am Tracy Malone, founder of NarcissistAbuseSupport.com, and I coach people all over the world. Can't see the dots there, but there's a lot of pins on that side. So if you need me, I'm here. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.